If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow & Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten. Rakuten.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Micro Brew, Milwaukee Brewers Chatter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We are so back, baby. We've got Kurt Hogue in the house. He is back fresh off of his latest vacation. My name is J.R. Radcliffe. We've got a lot of offseason happenings that we have got to get through today. I did still want to talk a little bit about some minor league players, some guys up and coming that are going to be potentially impacting this team in 2025, as well as some of the bigger names for beyond 2025. But before we get there, we've got so much. We've got awards that were handed out. We've got players who are no longer with the Brewers, whose contract situation we got a little clarity on. We've got a 23-year-old Japanese fireballer who is available to pretty much any team in the league, including the Brewers, if we want to entertain some wildly unlikely scenarios.
Here's to you, the Colorado Rockies.
Yeah, that's right. The Colorado Rockies have a third baseman named Ryan McMahon if the Brewers wanted to trade for him. Like, there's so many things that I want to discuss. But we're going to start in the most obvious place possible, Kurt, and that is with Taylor Swift. Since we last chatted, Kurt, you have seen Taylor Swift live and in concert in Indianapolis shortly after the end of the Major League Baseball season. Tell me everything you can tell me, Kurt Hogue, about your Taylor Swift concert-going experience.
You don't want that. The people don't want that.
The people do. I want that, and I'm.
They don't want. They don't want everything.
I don't understand.
Because then you said, "Tell me everything, JR." And if I did that, then we would be here for. Well, we're going to be here for an hour plus anyway, but we would be here for an hour plus, and I would just be telling you about the concert. So the great part is this. I had no idea going in what was happening. I knew Taylor Swift was performing, but I had like not seen a single video from the show.
No
I had
kidding.
Not watched. I had, not, you know, the whole movie on Disney Plus. I had.
Oh, wow. I saw most of that. I saw all kinds of that.
Nothing to do with that. I hadn't like. Perused the internet like Twitter or Reddit. We got to talk about Twitter, by the way, in a second.
What is
I had no idea what the set list was. I had no idea what the order was. Like, I knew how the Eras tour worked. She would go through her various eras, but I didn't know really anything beyond that.
I commend you. That's very difficult to have avoided all of that.
It was, well, this was, I mean, obviously this was a conscious effort. I could have gone to her very first weekend of shows in Phoenix. At spring training 2 years ago, Dom Catronio from WTMJ, he went and we were both looking around at tickets. And at the time I was like, that's not that much. If it's going to be that cheap, I'll definitely be able to go. And then I can, you know, my wife and I can go and we'll have a good time as opposed to me going by myself. Turns out the tickets did not stay at that price on the resale.
They got so expensiver.
A little bit expensive-y.
It became one of the biggest tours in modern American history, if not the biggest.
It was awesome. I mean, I was oscillating between screaming and like I was one of the, you know, teenagers that was there and in awe, honestly. That was the other reaction. The best part though, maybe not the best part, but the funniest part was walking out of the show. We got out of there pretty quickly because we're old and we had to be back the next day by like 10 a.m. And this was an indie, so we had to, you know, get up early and drive to pick up the kid. So we got out of there, you know, as soon as we could. And on the way out, there was just lines and lines of parents, JR.
Oh, no.
Just waiting to pick the kids. And I was like, why are you not in the show? Why didn't you go?
Incredible.
it was a fantastic experience. I had a great time. If you have been a follower for a while, you know I love Taylor Swift. I'm a big Swiftie, big fan. Mm. And this was one of my favorite live experiences in person. It did not salvage Indianapolis. It did not salvage Lucas Oil Stadium in my mind. I've been there for a lot of really bad Wisconsin Badgers events, sporting
bad
events.
Memories. Yeah.
And so I've compartmentalized them.
I see.
It was fun though to be there with my wife, and I could point out to various sections in the stadium. It's like, that's where I was when that happened. You see that corner of the end zone over there? 59 straight points. That's right. Count them up. 59.
Yeah.
And that was like the least bad one.
Where were you when Justice touched it?
Oh, I was like, see those floor seats down there? Like, you know, maybe about halfway back. Yeah. Yeah. That was me. So
I get the sense, because I did watch this on Disney Plus. I get the sense that it's the idea of theatrical these days in concerts is because you can do so much with the audio visual elements that you can really make it, you know, almost a theater production more so than a concert. Do you get that sense as well? Do you feel like that's what made it so good, is that there was so much, you know, there was so much setting and costume changes and video boards and things like that? Or was it more about the like raw emotion of the music?
I mean, a little bit of what you're talking about, but ultimately it was like, I just don't know how many people can do that set.
Yeah.
Or would do that set. I mean, it was 3.5 hours of nonstop, you know, moving and singing and all. I mean, you know, the stuff that went along with it was great. But I was there for the show, and the show knocked my socks off. I was barefoot driving home.
That's incredible.
And smelly.
Difficult to do. I bet. It's fine. Highway 65. Pretty easy to
navigate. What's the farthest you've driven bare feet?
I have maybe backed a car out of the driveway barefoot. I could not.
Really? You've never like gone to get fast food barefoot?
Nope. I don't drive anywhere barefoot. Man. I can't do it.
I've done that. Like, I can count it at least on two hands.
It's such a different feel on the gas pedal though. Like
I might need a third.
Well, I'm happy for you, Kurt. I'm happy that you got to live your dream. That would not be a show that I would choose to attend, but I respect it. I respect the Taylor Swift of it all. I did enjoy the show on Disney Plus, so you know, it's cool. I'm glad that you got that. I'm happy for you. I love that for you. We could talk about a little bit of baseball. So, like I said, so much has happened. The most recent, like as we record this on Tuesday night, we have another silver slugger in the house for the Milwaukee Brewers, William Contreras, winning that award for the National League at the catcher position. He has now won two consecutive silver slugger awards. Matt Arnold's trade in which he acquired William Contreras continues to be one of the greatest deals in Milwaukee Brewers history. I still can't quite believe that happened. We can talk about that. It isn't surprising that he won. He had the best offensive numbers by far of the three finalists. He was the best catcher in the National League by far. And maybe that in and of itself is interesting, that he has established himself as the best catcher in the National League offensively. That's wild to me. Maybe the question is how much longer we think he's going to be a catcher, if he is a catcher for the really long haul in his career. I don't know. I feel like this is underwhelming to start with Silver Slugger when there's so much else to go on, but we just got to take it chronologically. What do you think about William Contreras thus far? And do you think, I mean, obviously he's a starting catcher for 2025. I'm not positive who the backup is going to be. I assume it's Eric Haas, and I assume Jefferson Caro waiting in the wings after that. But is he a guy that you think is the catcher, say, 3 years from now, or however long he's going to be in Milwaukee? Do you think he's a catcher for his whole career?
Yeah, at this point, it feels like they do with Contreras what they did with Willy Adames, and you're just getting so much value from him at catcher. Like, his defense took a step back this year. He was pretty average, and you know, in just about every area. It's also hard to know like how much of controlling the running game now is even on catchers. How much they really matter, except like maybe the one or two best throwers. But yeah, he's the best catcher in baseball right now. That's where they're at, and when the Brewers have that, they have that at a cost controlled, as a cost controlled asset. They're more likely than not to just ride that out, it would seem. An extension would be really tough at this point for both sides. Not saying it's impossible, but you start to get that little sniff of like, you're not far from a huge payday. And Contreras will still be what, 29? Now the question is like, the fact that he's a catcher might make him more open to an extension, because the aging curve there is, it just is much more brutal than pretty much every other position on the baseball field. But you know, takes two to tango, and the Brewers are probably aware of that too. So like, you know, maybe this is just the way it ends up playing out, and he plays three more great years here and then he walks. But I mean, yeah, I don't want to have the thought of Contreras, you know, not being a Brewer, take away from what he's done the last 2 years, take away from him winning this award. Like I said, he is the best catcher in baseball right now. Who's number two? Is it Adley? Is it Cal Raleigh? Like Will Smith is probably still needs to be in that discussion too, but it feels pretty apparent who number one is.
Yeah, Real Muto, I guess, can be in that conversation, but like you said,
he's the aging curve. That's the aging curve, right?
You're
there.
Right. You know, that's a good point, because as I think about it, I think this is the offseason where maybe that's the surprise move, that they, you know, lock up William Contreras beyond these next few years. But there's examples of guys who don't age well, you know. I mean, Sean Murphy, remember, he was, of course, part of this same trade. Sean Murphy was the centerpiece of that deal that got, you know, that landed him, went from Oakland to Atlanta. And Sean Murphy got hurt, but already, like, no one's thinking about Sean Murphy as one of the best catchers, in baseball. William Contreras has long ago surpassed that, so it comes quickly for you. It can come very quickly. I wrote this at jsonline.com, the other Silver Slugger winners in Brewers history. Christian Yelich is the last one to do it, 2018, 2019. That comes as
Because I looked it up today.
can you name for me who before him?
There was one, the one from 1990, Dave Parker.
Yes, Dave Parker's
that's
a good
where
one.
I'm going to start. Okay. Also, the horse is riding into town right now. I can hear the clops in the background.
El Caballo, absolutely.
El Caballo, Prince Fielder, Giovanni Gallardo, Ryan Braun, of course, Christian Yelich, of course.
You've hit everyone from 1990. You did it. That's it.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a tough one. And then before that, it was Cooper. It was obviously Yount, obviously Molitor.
You got one more name. That's it. One-time winner, played the outfield.
Ogilvy.
There it is. Unbelievable work by you.
I was looking this up like 7 hours ago. I would hope I would
got it.
Have retained that information.
Incredible, though, to have retained Ogilvy. Giovanni Gallardo is the big one. Sad. Bygone era where pitchers could win Silver Sluggers. You're not going to see that anymore. But in 2010, he did indeed win one. Ryan Braun with five of them. That's as good as it gets in the Brewers organization. William Contreras is up to two. That's a pretty elite company, you know? That's Molitor and Yount and Braun and Cecil Cooper. And I think certainly Yelich.
Fielder,
that's it. That's a pretty good.
No, Fielder didn't do it.
Fielder did win it twice. Not consecutive. No, you're right. So even more rare if we're working on it that way. That's impressive stuff. Okay, the gold gloves are out. The platinum glove is out. Bryce Terang winning it, the first time any Brewers player has won the platinum glove. If we're being completely honest, people will talk about how gold gloves are a silly award. I understand that. The platinum glove, even sillier. There's a voting component that's a really big part of it. But still, and it's an award that's only been around for a little over a decade. But that's a guy who we obviously fawned over defensively all year long. And he was acknowledged as the best defender in the National League, regardless of position. Sal Frelick, I think that was a surprise, him winning a gold glove. I think if Bryce Terang hits enough, big question mark, of course, you're talking about a guy who can win five gold gloves in his career, which would match the franchise record set by George Scott back in the 70s at first base. We're getting ahead of ourselves there, but I think this is really cool for a couple of reasons. One is it sort of flies in the face of the old adage that offense gets you gold gloves, offense wins you defensive awards. That's obviously been overstated for the last many years, but Sal Frelick and Bryce Terang were two of the weaker hitters on this team. We've talked about that all year long. But they were acknowledged for what they do very well, and that is defense. And as much as we can poo-poo the Gold Gloves, rightfully, I think it's a little bit, it's a pretty inexact science. It still means a lot to the players. You know, I just go back to Lorenzo Cain, how meaningful that was in 2019. Should have won it in 2018, and then in 2019 he does, and how important that was to him, a very elite defender, to finally get one of those. I think this is probably pretty important to the players. And winning a Platinum Glove for Bryce Durang, 24 years old, first time winner of a Gold Glove, I mean, that is a huge notch in terms of how people look at him across baseball. You know, that's a really impressive, that's a really impressive thing, I think. And even though it might be a little bit subjective and a little silly, I think this is a big deal for the Milwaukee Brewers. The Gold Gloves do not come to this franchise on trees. You know, like, they are very, very rare, very few and far between. To get two in the same year, I think, is finally an acknowledgement of how good the defense has gotten in Milwaukee. And I found it very uplifting. Maybe it was at a point where, you know, the Packers had just lost. Those were announced on a Sunday. The Packers had lost. The Badgers were bad. Everything was kind of falling apart. It was nice to finally have something you could hang your hat on.
Speak for yourself.
Well, you were having a fine Sunday night.
I was going through the Red album.
That's
when,
right,
those were announced. So
was that your favorite era? Was that the best of the eras?
I think it actually might have been. Yeah, mm-hmm. In the show.
All right.
I'm a proponent that the album is great, the song is not, in terms of Red. I was pleasantly surprised by Evermore. Thought that was great in the show. Obviously, 1989 is what it is, but
of course,
Red just has some bangers. Anyway, how much do you think a Platinum Glove is worth in arbitration? I would love to find out. I would love to find that out. At least I did. I don't remember if you were fully in this with me. But I was pretty sure the Brewers might not win one this year.
Oh, I was 100%. 100%.
Certainly not more than one, because that's just the status quo. But I think we're getting to a point where the Gold Glove winners are actually, like, it's actually pretty good now. Contreras being left off last year was a notable omission, but he was like a finalist, but he wasn't going to win it anyway. Do you remember who won catcher last year in the National League? Was it Patrick Bailey? I feel like they messed that up last year. I feel like Patrick Bailey or Contreras should have won it, and Contreras was not a finalist. But across the board this year, they were pretty spot on. I mean, there may have maybe a couple arguments you could have here or there, but like, there's no Yadier Molina winning 10 Gold Gloves based off his reputation anymore. So
Gabriel Moreno, by the way, from the D-backs.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, he's a good defensive catcher. He's the guy with the arm. That's the elite arm we were just talking about. But I don't know. You were talking about, we kind of like can overlook Gold Gloves, but I'm not so sure if it keeps going like this. It's losing steam. I think it might be gaining steam with the way that the winners lined up with both the eye test and the metrics. And the eye test and the metrics were a bit at odds with Terang this year. And we talked about that, and we wrote about that as well, where DRS said, this guy's like the best defender in baseball. And then some of the other metrics are like, he's pretty average to slightly above average. And you watch him, you're like, I've never seen a guy play the infield like this for the Brewers. So, yeah, ultimately well-deserved. Frelix, the eye test, that's an interesting one for me. I don't know about where you fell on Frelix defense this year. Just like, if you didn't have any numbers, I would have said it was solid, but not amazing. Because if you remember when he was in left field, it was pretty rough early in the season. I think there are some plays, maybe even in Baltimore, out there with the Great Wall, Baltimore, where he was super shaky, and that's why they ended up, you know, Churio ended up moving over to left full time. Drop my phone, and Frelick went to right full time. I don't know, they have numbers in front of me either, but if you look at it, I would bet you Frelick was pretty rough in a very short sample in left, and then in a right was just like made every play, robbed homers. Pretty good arm, just all around excellent, and kind of wanted the way Terang did, where he was just really, really solid in in every way and didn't mess anything up.
Yeah, I don't know if it's because he's small in stature. It maybe looks like it's a little more effort than normal to do what might be a seemingly normal play. I mean, the arm is sneaky good. You know, I don't expect Sal Frelick to uncork some of the seeds that he has uncorked this year. I think it's just good positioning. He's obviously fast. He's robbed homers. And, you know, like when you think of him, he's made some diving plays, but he hasn't made, I don't know. I don't know why I say I don't think of flashy plays, because he's made a lot of them. But it's just something about the eye test that is different with him. And but stats back it up. You know, he's regarded well if you look at some of the statistical measures. And I think, you know, going back to your point about how defense really, you know, this is becoming a more expertly chosen award. You know, Blake Perkins as a finalist in center field, that's pretty impressive to me, because he's a part-time player who's not a good offensive player. And, you know, we watch him and think, oh my gosh, he's so elite. And maybe just having the sheer volume of home run thefts had to pay off,
yeah,
in this game.
I think that got him. Yeah. Cause like Pico Armstrong is probably a better defender than Perkins this year, but
you're probably right. Yeah. He certainly had developed a reputation as being very good as well. But yeah, I was pleasantly surprised. I thought it was really cool. I do think Bryce Turang deserves it. It's very difficult to say what you think a player deserves, because you and I only saw the Brewers this year. Yes, obviously we saw every team to some degree, but it's really hard to appreciate a player unless you watch them constantly. And there's no tried and trusted stats.
Defense in particular. Like, we have a great idea of what these guys are as defenders, but outside of like most of the elite guys, it's largely just based off of reputations and like one click on, you know, Fangraphs 100%. Or Savant or Baseball Reference.
But what else could it be?
Yeah. Like, by the way, Sal Frelick, -4 defensive runs saved in 24 games and left. And then he led all right fielders in defensive runs saved. It was just really funny how that kind of worked out to his advantage in a way that, like, he got all of his. Remember, he was coming back from that third alt, like just trying third base. They played him at third base all spring. And then it was like, oh, this is not good. This guy has not played a lot of outfield in the last 6 months.
Huh.
And then he just played elite right field. Very funny how that works out.
Tried to make a play that almost cost him a chance to appear in the postseason, if I'm sure everyone remembers. Got hurt in the last series of the year. Did not look good that he would play in the postseason. Of course, did. Hit an unbelievable, unforgettable home run. Didn't end up mattering in the end, but still a really good moment. And a reason, I think, why people are going to be higher on Sal coming into 2025. He's got a gold glove. He had a home run in a big spot. We've talked about how if he swings harder, there's maybe some pretty good results still in there. I think the arrow points up on Sal Frelick going into 2025. Which is interesting. I wouldn't have thought that maybe 2 weeks before the end of the season. In other sort of awards news, Matt Arnold, Executive of the Year for the Milwaukee Brewers. That's cool. Typically, I think with those things, there's usually like 3 or 4 Executive of the Year awards, and they kind of go to 4 different guys. I think he won a couple of them this year, which I think is pretty cool.
He got Sporting News, which... Does Sporting News still exist?
It does.
Do they still mail out a physical copy?
Oh, that I couldn't tell you at all. I don't know about that. I don't think so. But I will say, like, Vinny Iyer is one of the guys that I'm citing when I'm doing roundups of various things. Yeah, they've got some writers. They've got some good stuff.
Okay. So where are they on the Sports Illustrated version of, or the Sports Illustrated scale of what happened here?
They are below Sports Illustrated, coming from a much higher perch to a much lower depth, is the more notable example of what happened here.
But so, Sporting News was still pretty great. I'm associating like the magazines I got in like fifth grade here with where they stood. But Sporting News to me was still pretty good.
I think we would all need to come to terms, if we were younger versions of ourselves, that there are no such thing really as sports print magazines anymore, like those publications, you know, that are, you know, 100 pages, or even like preview magazines. I'm sure they're out there, but I don't think they're like prevalent. I think pretty much it all happens online. You know, you want to know about the draft, you read The Beast, Dane Brugler's The Beast on The Athletic. You don't actually get a copy of, you know, a whole guide with all the draft picks like maybe you'd used to. Sorry, RIP.
I don't know. I feel like baseball still has some pretty good previews.
Maybe. Other awards, finalists for Rookie of the Year, that'd be Jackson Chourio. Manager of the Year, Pat Murphy. I think we believe they will finish on opposite ends of the voting there. Chourio up against two very difficult opponents here in Jackson Merrill, who won a Silver Slugger. Jackson Merrill did. Jackson Chourio, a finalist, did not, but that was not a surprise. And then Pat Murphy, who I think is the far and away front runner for Manager of the Year. We will find all of that out next week. It would not surprise me if it goes exactly how we think there. Murphy first, Chourio third in their respective awards. I think I want to talk before we get to some of the actual roster stuff. I want to talk about Roki Sasaki just real briefly, because I wrote about this again at jsonline.com. He is a free agent pitcher coming from Japan. He's 23 years old. He is, shocker, regarded as one of the best pitchers on planet Earth. He is in a very unique situation relative to what people think of when players come from Japan, when they're major league free agents and they can sign for a bajillion dollars like Yamamoto did with the Dodgers last year, or many other examples before that. Interestingly, though, Shohei Ohtani, not one of those examples. If you are under the age of 25, we could go through all the minutiae and the rules, but you must sign as an international minor league free agent. You are not signing as
a very weird rule.
It's very weird. And what that means is that you can sign a player using your international bonus pool, which is capped every year. Usually that bonus pool goes to Latin American 15-year-olds or 16-year-olds, whatever the bare minimum you have to be is. In this case, you could spend all that money on one player if you wanted, on Roki Sasaki. And who wouldn't want to do that? Because you would sign him for cheap, for like $7 million, because that's the most any team can spend on an international free agent class, and immediately add him to the big league roster. He would still be a player that goes through 3 years of arbitration. It would be like any other minor leaguer that you bring in off the street, except he would be capable of leading you immediately into one of the top tiers, you know, the top tier of baseball. So it's super interesting. It puts all 30 teams in play. It basically, long story short, and you could read more about this at jsonline.com if you want, but long story short, it isn't about which team can offer him the most money, because they can all offer him about the same. Actually, the Brewers are one of the teams that could maybe offer him among the most. But it's going to just be where Sasaki wants to go. Where does he want to go in Major League Baseball? It won't be for money. It'll be because he just wants to go there. One would assume that still means, you know, the Dodgers or the Yankees or one of the other big ticket, you know, teams that has a big footprint in overseas markets. But we have no idea. So, Kurt, could the Brewers get their sneaky good signing, being not so sneaky at all, one of the best players on the market for dirt cheap? Could that happen for the Milwaukee Brewers this offseason?
Sure.
Yeah, sure. They could also sign Juan Soto. Who knows?
I mean, like, there's certainly a lot, a much worse places for him to go.
100%.
Like,
yeah.
So, okay. We love Wisconsin and we love Milwaukee. And part of that is like, you know, we're from this state. We've spent a lot of time living in this area. So I don't know how much of it is. I don't think it's confirmation bias, but I think it's like the after effects of like living here and realizing how cool the summers are. Because that does not seem to like, I just don't see that mattering to someone like Roki Sasaki, or, you know, point to any other large free agent in baseball or basketball in years past. No one ever is like, yeah, Milwaukee, you know, the really good players. You hear players all the time talk about they love playing here, but like, it doesn't, it's Milwaukee's awesomeness is not used as effective capital in swaying great players to come here. But maybe it should be. Maybe it should be. Like, you always hear the talk about living in LA or like living in Miami. And I'm like, have you been to LA? I want nothing to do with living there. Nothing. You know what's awesome is living where I live, and I can get to the other side of a city, the other side of the metro area in 35 minutes tops. Driving. That's true. Awesome. And like LA doesn't even have a subway. Well, they probably do have like
sandwich shops. Yeah. They also have Quiznos, I would guess. No Cousin Subs. Is Quiznos still a thing, actually? Speaking of sporting news.
I don't know, but I love Quiznos.
I was big on Quiznos in like seventh grade. There was some.
Did you see TGI Fridays going bankrupt? Former tenant in Milwaukee, in Miller Park, where
yeah,
used to be TGI Fridays Front Row Grill. Not anymore,
yeah,
man.
Yeah. Can you name all the inhabitants or the names of the third level club area above the bleachers?
No, it was the Gale Club. It was the 300 Club.
I don't remember that one. Yeah, remember Medavante? Medavante Club?
No, I absolutely do not. Sounds awesome. Mm. Sounds like a
was
good
Badger time. Was Badger Meter involved in here somehow?
I have no idea what that is. No,
I made that up. Okay. Anyway, X Golf is there now. Anyway, just like tell him, like, dude, you actually might not love living in LA, but you will like it here. Everyone likes it here when they come here. They're always pleasantly surprised. So
that's right.
Perhaps the Brewers could use that. Perhaps they could use, I don't know, like they're really good at developing pitchers and, hey, do you want to make the most money possible in 6 years? Hey, have you seen this guy, Corbin Burns? Maybe heard of him?
I have.
Josh Hader, Devin Williams, Brandon Woodruff.
We'll see if any of them are here. Yeah. Brandon Woodruff
is here. So, you know, those are pretty good examples to tout. Like the Brewers do not have a terrible case here. But ultimately, I think what I'm interested in watching is, this is maybe like the nerdy side of it, is how much of a team's bonus money they end up spending on him. Like, does it turn into some sort of, does it turn into a bidding war with like relative pennies for an elite player? Or, you know, because does a team have to give its entire pool to one guy?
Yeah.
And just like, because these things take years and lots of work from a lot of people to build up. There are tons of people on, you know, just the Brewers, for example, that spend their time and their entire job is to figure out like the 20 something guys that'll be in this year's class. And suddenly if you're throwing almost all the money or all of it at one guy,
you're burning all that work down.
Yeah. Not to mention, you know, some bridges that you could be burning there as well. So,
yeah, there are multiple complications. You're right about that. Teams would probably have to swear off, you know, basically not honor agreements that they have with players to make that work.
Yeah. And that's if he's posted as a 2025
yes,
signee.
Yeah, that's a complication. If he's posted before December 2nd, which is, I think, almost like a bureaucratic decision, not necessarily like because the team or the player wants to, then it is in the 2024 class. And then the Dodgers end up getting the financial leg up too, because they happen to be one of the teams that has a fair amount of international bonus money remaining. Now, that's like $2.5 million. It's nothing. But that's what Shohei Ohtani signed for when he came here for the Anaheim Angels. Posting fees were different then. So Shohei Ohtani's, you know, the Nippon Ham Fighters still got paid big. That will not be happening in this case because the rules have changed and the posting team will only get basically 20% of the contract. So they're going to get just a couple million out of this. I think if money motivated this guy, he would have waited 2 years, because if he did wait 2 years, he would be making $335 million like Yamamoto is. And so it's curious that he just wants to go so badly now. I'm assuming money isn't really an object and it doesn't matter which dollar figure he signs for. You know, the other complication here is teams can actually trade to get more money in their international bonus pool. So you could theoretically trade, let's say, I don't know, Devin Williams for a ton of international bonus pool money. That might not seem like a lot, but if that's the money you're using to woo Sasaki, it's a huge amount. We've probably spent way too much time talking about this because it's so unlikely that he signs here. I mean, is Milwaukee?
We know what's going to happen here.
He'll go to the Dodgers.
He will probably be with the Dodgers. If not, you could pick two or three other teams involving, including the Padres, that will be in the running. But no, like, I don't think we're spending too much time on it. Just from like a fun, quirky possible scenarios that this could happen. Yeah. That just doesn't pop up very often. Where, yeah, what if a team suddenly like gets word that if we have like 25 million, and also what are players worth on the international, like in we can, you know, come up with prospect capital
and you know what their free agent money is worth, but like, I don't know what is a prospect worth in terms of international bonus pool money. Teams probably have that answer, but I don't. What would, I don't know, what would like a number three starter, or what would like an Aaron Civale net you in international bonus money? I have no clue. And what would it take to pool together $10 million extra? Would it matter? Probably not, but
we are talking about a player who could transform the Brewers into a championship contender just for a few million dollars.
What if you use your entire pool on him, and that like Jackson, that was the year you were going to sign Jackson Churio.
Sure. But again, like, you know, Jackson Churio is such a lottery ticket. Those guys come along only once in a blue moon. You're talking about a guy who you're pretty sure for the next 3 years will be with you and pretty dang good. Or four years, even. I don't know quite how that would work. It'd be 4 years.
Congrats. You got pitcher Jackson Churio. I guess that's the answer to that, huh?
Yeah. And a guy who can help immediately. Like there's no development required here. There's no extra resources. He'll almost certainly pick a high profile team. I can't imagine a scenario. Otherwise, you know, Milwaukee is great. Major League Baseball players tend to be older just by virtue of the system when they get here and thus already raising families. Milwaukee is phenomenal for raising families. And I think if you're 23 young and hip, you're probably not so much interested in that. And maybe you want to go a place where there's a healthy Japanese American community, like someplace, I don't know, on the West Coast. Probably not getting that in Milwaukee.
What about Polish people?
You're right. If you are a Polish American superstar coming to the big leagues, congratulations, you're a pioneer. You're the first of your kind. And you're right. Living in Cudahy, South Milwaukee, hanging out, that could work out for you. You're absolutely right. Is there a strong, like, actual Polish community in Milwaukee?
Of course. Room Service in Bayview. That's a Japanese restaurant.
We're headed down dangerous path, I think. He's going to be a Dodger. Congratulations to the Los Angeles Dodgers.
Go there. I kind of. It's a little expensive, but
I'm pretty hungry for that.
I kind of want it now.
Yeah, I'm.
Anyway, he wants the Dodgers. Yeah.
So that was a waste of time, but let's talk about some of the players who are. who were with the Brewers that are no longer, because there's a couple surprises on this list. First, I want to talk about Willy Adames, who was given the qualifying offer by the Milwaukee Brewers, of course. So if he wants to come back for like 1 year, $23 million, it's on the table for him. He could do it. He ain't gonna, because he's going to get the bag. We've talked about this over and over. Maybe the Dodgers, actually. We've talked about this over and over about how he's not likely to come back for a number of reasons, including the Brewers are equipped to move on. And signing him might genuinely be a bad investment given just the simple aging curve. But of course, there was a little bit of chatter. Jim Bowden, I believe, of The Athletic, not someone who is known for kind of having these details quite right, but still indicating that Willy Adames would be open to returning, even for less than what might be like the top of the market value, even though we've heard players say that over and over and over throughout history. It is just keeping their options open. It is smart business to say these things, but... Do you believe, has anything about your belief system changed? I still see, say, 0% chance that Willy Adames is back. Is it still 0% for you? Or do you allow for a little bit of glimmer?
It's always been a little more than 0% because we knew this sentiment from Willy Adames, but we also know the other side of things, which is like, he's still going to want to get paid and the Brewers just aren't going to play in that market.
Yeah.
So... It would take some unfortunate circumstances for Adames this offseason probably, and I just really don't see a way that happens with this free agent class and the year he just had and his age and just like all that he brings to Willy Adames deserves to get paid and good for him. It's just not gonna happen in Milwaukee.
Yeah, it just isn't.
Which, by the way, I do not believe, correct me if I'm wrong, I shouldn't be wrong about this because it is literally my job. I don't think the Brewers ever actually announced that they gave the qualifying offer to Adames. They did.
But yeah, it was reported. I don't know. Is it the type of thing teams announce?
It was a bit peculiar that they didn't. I don't know. I saw like the Orioles announced theirs. I don't know if the Brewers have ever
given a qualifying offer, so I'm unfamiliar with the proceedings there.
This is new terrain for them too.
I thought it peculiar that they didn't at least like come out and say they did, because they did. But
That's amazing. But this is a very rare thing for them. Most often they usually are not even in the ballpark of being able to offer players that amount of money. The qualifying offer, if the player accepts it, they usually aren't even equipped financially to do that much. They would of course be willing to spend 1 year, $22 million.
Do you know when the qualifying offer began?
As a concept, I don't. It's probably been a decade at least, right? When the qualifying offer system began,
2012. So yeah, that would have been post Fielder.
Right. So, oh, you're right. Was it the 2012 draft? Because that would have involved Fielder coming out of the 2011 season. Or was it during the 2012 season? The
qualifying offer was implemented in 2012. I'm going to guess that means that post the 2012 season.
For the 2013 draft.
Unless I'm forgetting someone, which is very plausible. Mm. I don't think the Brewers, like Moustakas, did they have a qualifying offer to Moustakas or Grandal?
No, I don't think so, because they could have no, I don't believe so.
Bizarre that they didn't give it to Grandal.
I would have loved to have seen them bring back Yosemite Grandal. Even in my heart of hearts, I still wish they had done that, even though history bore out that that would have been a bad decision. It's like with Willy Adames. I'm still of two minds of it. I know it would be a bad decision. It's not a good idea. I mean, if he accepts a qualifying offer, that's a fine thing for the Brewers.
It's a great thing for the Brewers.
That would be a miracle. Realistically, though, signing him to a six-year deal would be bad. It would be really unwise.
It could be bad. Yeah,
it could be bad. You're right.
Yeah. If you continue to operate in the way that you operate now, like, you know, you break from your mold to sign Adames to this deal, but don't break the rest of the mold, there would be some kinks.
I completely agree. Other players that are no longer with the Milwaukee Brewers because of a series of roster machinations, Colin Ray.
Let us remember that. Colin Ray. Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it was like a couple weeks ago now.
We'll pull one out. Surprising. Colin Ray was, of course, the big surprise, and we'll talk about him in a second. Kevin Hergett, Bryce Wilson, Rob Zestrizny, Frankie Montas, Jake Bowers, Gary Sanchez. None of them are likely. I say likely because I don't know if it's like completely out of the realm of possibility at all that they'll be back, but none of them are likely to be back next year. There are three that I find particularly intriguing. One is Colin Ray, for obvious reasons. He was a very serviceable number two starter, and I want to talk about the method that they used to part ways with him as well. Two is Frankie Montas, because he is the one who declined his half of the mutual option for $20 million, which I find amazing. I mean,
that is what the Brewers said.
That is what the Brewers said. I think I understand why that happened, but that's interesting. And three is Kevin Hergett, because he's no one's going to miss Kevin Hergett. I understand that.
That's not true.
He was intriguing enough to me that I am surprised the team just parted ways. There were other guys they could have parted with who are not as good as Kevin Hergett, but whatever. So I'll let you have the floor. Gave you a lot of names, a lot of thoughts. Ramble for me. Tell me what you think of all these moves.
Ultimately, Colin Ray not being on this roster next year is not a huge surprise. Like we did the story on the projected payroll, and we touched on this a couple episodes ago. We had it around 113.8, if 115, that ballpark. I don't remember what the exact number was, but it was right there. And that's already like pretty high going into an offseason for the Brewers. And that's largely based off just like they have more hard salary commitments this year, thanks to Rhys Hoskins' contract. So because of that, you start looking at ways where they can chip away from that. And Aaron Civale's arbitration deal is one option. Devin Williams' arbitration deal is another option. By the way, not picking up their team option on him was obviously the sensible thing for the team to do in that situation, because then they retain the rights for arbitration. But Colin Ray's option was the third of those, because you can save either $4.5 million or $5.5 million, depending on how things go with him. And that's probably just what they're going to have to do. Like, if the Brewers were in a different position financially this offseason, they might have kept him and just, you know, had him eat innings in the very consistent, reliable way that he does. But there is a need. It seems pretty clear from the way that they've operated in the last couple of weeks. There's a need to find some space in the old budget. So unfortunately for Colin Ray, that meant they declined his option. Now, fortunately for Colin Ray, someone will sign him to a deal that's worth more than that. He did not get picked up on waivers. Everyone could have claimed him for that salary. So that's not a great sign for him, but, hopefully, you know, this is like his best chance at getting paid in his career, going through free agency. So ultimately not a surprise that he's not here next year, but a little surprise that he went through waivers. It's not a great way to, it's not a great way for the players. Like, you can handle it however you want. If you're the team, it's business. That's not the best way for it to go for the player though. Yeah.
Well, let me talk to you about that, because you could also interpret waivers is interesting, because essentially it means that the team is hoping somebody picks him up so that they don't have to pay the $1 million buyout on his contract. The team would have control of him at the current contract. Now, you could argue that they were trying to do right by the player to have somebody take him at that contract instead of have to go back to the free market. But I don't know what I believe there.
No, there are instances in which that is the case in the offseason, but that's mostly for arbitration eligible players like Jake Bowers and Bryce Wilson, who were also waived because the Brewers knew they were not going to non-tender them. I think they did it with Brent Suter too, if I remember that correctly. Not 100% on that, so maybe fact check that yourself while I ramble here. But you know you're not going to pick up, you know, the arbitration option on Wilson and Bowers. So you go, okay, we're just going to waive these guys. And hopefully for them, someone picks them up, because I don't know if Bryce Wilson's projected for what, $2-3 million in arbitration. He might not get that, probably won't get that on the open market this winter. So let's see if someone picks him up and they lock him in for an arbitration salary. That'd be good for the player, as opposed to just, you know, like, it also lets them start exploring their options earlier than if you wait till the tender deadline. So that I get.
Yeah.
But in this situation, this is not, it ultimately ended up being fine for Colin Ray, but you know,
same
if you thing. Want to talk about the doing right for the player, it would probably be just let him go. Because trading him or waiving him saves you $1 million, but then he can't pick his team. But then again, the Brewers like don't necessarily need to care about that. It's business. When they can save $1 million, they're going to save $1 million.
Yeah. Yes, they did that with Brent Suter, and they painted it as a in deference to the player to try to get his contract picked up. Brent Suter, who's had a very nice career since then, that was kind of the mentality there. But it did feel a little different this time around. And I mean, we'll talk more about doing right by the player, because I'll have some Devin Williams conversation to come. But I still wanted to touch on Kevin Hergett. And if there were any other surprises here, I know Kevin Hergett is not going to move the needle for people, but like, there are other guys on this 40 man that I would have dropped before him. I think he's kind of intriguing.
Sure. And I think those guys might still be dropped.
Oh, okay. Whatever.
Yeah. I mean, the 40 man's what, down to 36 now. So they have cleared some room for some, for the rule five protections, but there'll be more guys that filter their way on into this roster in the offseason. I was a little surprised Kevin Hergett was on the early train out, but you know, he landed in a good station in New York. It's not at all a surprise that David Stearns picked up the guy the Brewers dropped. He's an interesting arm for sure, but like, ultimately, yeah, could just. I really like Kevin Hergett. I think that changeup is awesome, but you know, the most likely outcome is it's just like a fringe 40 man arm, and
yeah, you're
those
right.
Come and they go.
we were talking about Jake Cousins when we watched him in the World Series. I think last time we podded, we're like, oh, Jake Cousins, the Brewers might have let him go too early. And then he kind of got lit up in the World Series after that. So maybe we're a curse. I'm not sure. Zastrzyzny claimed by the Cubs. Like you said, the Mets going after Kevin Hergett there on waivers. Montas declining his half of the option. I think I understand this, and you can tell me if you feel differently. I think this is a situation where it was like a $20 million option. The Brewers were obviously going to decline that. Montas doing so at least makes it seem like, you know, rather than, oh, the team decided I wasn't worth $20 million, I was like, well, I'm not going to, I don't think that contract is for me. Now, at least maybe you can defend it on the open market to say, well, I got out of that. If you, you know, I'm still worth that or something. I'm not really sure. But it, I
you
mean,
can't
if I'm
fire me.
Right.
I quit.
That's exactly right. Because there's no scenario I can think of where Frankie Montas would say to himself, $20 million isn't worth it for me. isn't good enough. I don't know.
And it would take a lot for Frankie Montas to get that even in a multi-year deal this winter. I don't know. Who knows? Maybe Pac-Man is out there running some team and he loves himself some innings eaters, even if it's like 5 1/3 innings.
Yeah.
But I think you're on. I think you're spot on.
Devin Williams, the Brewers declined his option and he will go back in through the arbitration process. He's still under team control. He'll make about $2.5 million, maybe a little more or less through arbitration because he was injured for most of the season. And it, not that anyone knows exactly how the arbitration process will go, but it stands to reason based on, you know, figuring out similar contract situations in the past that he'll make less money than he would have on the $10.5 million option that he had on that contract that he signed last year. Again, I come back to doing right by the player. $2.5 million or $3 million is a lot. It's not something that if you don't have to spend, I can understand the Brewers completely saying, yeah, we're not going to spend that. On the other hand, I think everybody seems to believe that Devin Williams' days in Milwaukee are very much numbered. Whether or not he gets traded this offseason, we'll talk about. I don't think that's a slam dunk by any means, but it seems like Devin Williams and the Brewers haven't always seen eye to eye on things. And I can't imagine it's helped by them declining an option to theoretically save a couple $1 million on a player who could very well be on the payroll next year and pitching next year. It certainly falls in line with what they did with Corbin Burns when they saved less than $1 million in order to go to an arbitration hearing. But I don't know. It between Colin Ray and Devin Williams, it kind of just feels a little bit sour. I still understand it. Again, I'm of two minds. Like, it makes financial sense. This team can't afford to have superfluous $2 to $3 million, components of contracts lying around. But I don't know, man. It feels kind of weird.
People like to point to the Ohtani and the Yamamoto and the Freeman and the Betts deals to show the difference between the Dodgers and the Brewers.
Of course.
That's not the difference between the Dodgers and the... Okay, yes, it is. But for the sake of my argument here, that's not the difference between the Dodgers and the Brewers. The difference between the Dodgers and the Brewers is this. Right before the Brewers waived Colin Ray, or maybe while he was on waivers, and right before they declined Devin Williams' team option, I saw news come through that the Dodgers had picked up Austin Barnes' team option for next year.
Okay.
That's the difference between the Brewers and the Dodgers.
Yeah.
Is they're like, sure, it's a few million. That doesn't matter. We're going to be in the tax. You're Clayton Kershaw's buddy. You can be our backup catcher, pal. We'll still win 98 games and, you know, probably go back to losing in the NLDS next year. And the Brewers are like, for the Brewers, that's they can't operate like that. So, I mean, yeah, sure. Would I want a 25% pay cut? Do our bosses listen to this? I should stop this example.
Absolutely not. No, you're fine.
Okay.
Speak freely.
Okay. Well, I would really not like the 25% pay cut. Don't even consider that, please, if you do listen to this.
Can I get that as a posting fee? Can I get that as a posting fee, the 25% pay cut? I'd like to try it. I'd like to see if that works here.
Yes. Yeah. Can you post me somewhere else? No, just kidding. That was a joke.
Now that
my employment is on the line, 25% pay cut. No one wants that. But like, that's the contract you signed. The Brewers had the team option.
Devin Williams, you know, he probably got a little more money up front in arbitration last year in exchange for this end of the deal this year. And also, if the Brewers trade him, which is still on the table, although you and I have both spoken about this and we don't think that's for sure a given thing at this point, it is to their benefit to take the cheaper option. And they frankly should in this case. It would be bad business if you weren't.
It's true.
That's unfortunately kind of the crappy side of baseball. But that's baseball, Susan.
You know, we talk about this clubhouse as potentially being kind of a good clubhouse from time to time. It's like, well, part of being a good clubhouse is bringing back guys like, you know, the backup catcher, because he's good for morale. He's been around a while. You know, the Brewers would never do that. So I don't know. I guess it's still to their credit that they're able to cultivate what I think we regard as a pretty nice clubhouse, pretty good clubhouse year after year after year. But there's so much turnover because you simply cannot afford to pay what the Dodgers are able to pay on the, you know, on the fringes. Forget the main guys. So I don't know. Just some rambling thoughts, I guess. So Devin Williams, will he get traded? Everybody seems to think that because A, he's about to be a free agent and he's very, very good and probably will not have as good a value as he does right now, playoffs notwithstanding, because he is, you know, probably in the peak of his career at this point. And two, this is how the Brewers operate. Everyone assumes that he's going to get traded. But I got to tell you, if you want to get a relief pitcher this offseason, you could do it without giving up any key prospects, because there's a whole bucket of them available open market.
You might just have to do multiple years of a contract.
Sure. So,
Its downside, for sure.
Yeah, you're right. You probably don't want to sign a guy like Tanner Scott to a multi-year contract, I suppose, or Carlos Estevez.
A five-year deal or something, yeah.
You're right. That sort of expiring contract nature is suddenly an asset. But I don't think the Brewers can get anything for Devin Williams. Now, I say anything. Of course they could get something for Devin Williams. I don't think they can get anything worth what they would be surrendering. I know that they're very good at manufacturing relief pitchers, but like Devin Williams is truly a dude. And I would still take him as the closer 10 times out of 10, no matter how good they've made this bullpen the last few years. I don't think they can get what they want to get for him. Now it might be a little bit of a forced hand situation. If Devin Williams and the Brewers are at odds enough that it might just be silly to try to bring him back. But gosh, I really feel like you look at the landscape and this is not the time. It's just not to trade Devin Williams. I don't know if they would still do it at the trade deadline, because I feel like if they're in the race, they're probably not going to be willing to do that. Just like with Willy Adames. But I don't know. What are you thinking about Devin Williams' future here?
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm pretty close to a 50-50 on whether or not they trade him, like split down the middle. The thing about this year's market, though, is if you buy into the capital C closer thing, it's Devin Williams. I mean, Tanner Scott's out there, and there's, you know, there's a handful of other, like, good relievers. And the league doesn't operate it. And Ryan Helsley actually will be probably on the trade market as well. I would think Ryan Helsley will be traded,
that's interesting.
You know, I'm very curious to see what ends up, you know, happening in that deal and how that affects what the Brewers try to do with Williams. You know, it could play out a couple of different ways where so a team misses out on him and wants him even more, or it just depletes the market even further. But like there's not a ton of teams in this day and age that I can see paying the premium that the Brewers will rightfully ask teams to pay on Williams to get the capital C closer. The one that comes to mind is the Yankees.
Well, yeah,
because like, you think of the Yankees, the Yankees could use him. The Yankees could, I mean, Luke Weaver, they picked up their team option, but like, you don't think the Yankees are interested in a year of Devin Williams at that price and then maybe luring him for longer? Like, that's sure. One, but I mean, the Padres always come to mind too, because AJ Preller loves to pay for contract or pay heavy contracts to relievers.
Maybe there's a couple more in there, but like those are the two that pop in my mind. The Orioles again.
The Yankees just went to the World Series without a capital C closer because Clay Holmes wasn't that guy anymore.
Did they win it?
Well, no, but Luke Weaver was pretty awesome for the majority of the postseason, filling in that spot.
Maybe. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. What about the Giants? What about the Giants? We don't know what Buster Posey does, but.
No, that's true. Okay, you've at least talked me into the idea that there are suitors out there because that's all it's going to take is having some suitors out there.
It's tricky. It's tricky, right? Because there's not a lot of historical precedent for elite relievers, closers, elite closers with 1 year left being traded. There's precedent for elite closers being traded, like Edwin Diaz, Josh Hader. Is one that comes to mind. Like Josh Hader is the comp here, but it wasn't the offseason. Craig Kimbrell at some point, but they were like that context was a little, that trade was different. So I don't know. It is the big mystery. And I think if you think the Brewers are set one way or the other, you are misreading the situation. They could trade him and they will certainly look to do so. But that doesn't mean, like you said earlier, that they will, because he's still worth a lot to this Brewers team.
As we get into the nuts and bolts of the offseason, we've observed the last couple of years, the offseason really sort of stretches later and later and later. Guys don't sign, dominoes don't start falling. So it's really hard to see who's going to be available for theoretically cheap, you know, later in the year. Those are the guys that the Brewers might try to spring upon. Where do you think this team improves? Because third base, by the way, another black hole in terms of who's available in the free agent market. I've said the name Alex Bregman before. Sure, the Brewers and every other team who want to improve at third base would be in the market for one guy because there really is no one else after Alex Bregman. You have talked me into the idea of Ha-Seong Kim of the Padres. Got a little, I think, an injury issue. But if they were to just simply replace Willy Adames at shortstop, you leave Joey Ortiz at third base, who, quite honestly, Joey Ortiz is as good a third baseman as any you're going to be able to get on the free agent market right now. So that could be an area where they improve. Maybe it's Gleyber Torres and you try to use him at second and have Bryce Turang move to shortstop. I mean, they do have options in terms of who slides over, but it's hard to see them just straight up improving. I know you've said there could be a trade that would make the most sense, but I don't know how they're going to go about improving. I don't know if even as creative as Matt Arnold has been, if those options are just going to be there. It's really a puzzle to me. Where do you think this team actually improves this offseason, if you had to guess?
Well, the Ha-Seong Kim thing, I mean, there's probably like eight or so teams right now that are like, wow, we need this guy. That's so funny. I don't think the Brewers are like alone in needing a shortstop and like that could be a good landing spot, but it really could be a great landing spot for him. And also, what if they do improve at shortstop with Ha-Seong Kim? Like, okay, it's not out of the realm of possibility that he's worth four wins next year.
So you mean take the whole puzzle because he's better defensively than Willy Adames
was. He's been a league average hitter in his career.
Sure.
And he runs the bases and he is an elite defender. Elite. I don't know.
That would be interesting. They'd have to get a little more offense from somewhere. And either that's Joey Ortiz getting better, Rhys Hoskins getting back to something, maybe a full year of Jackson Churio accounts for some of that. Maybe a full year of Christian Yelich, which I don't think anybody can really hope for. Maybe a full year of Garrett Mitchell, which is also not something I don't know where the offense comes from that they didn't already have. I think, I don't know. It's a very incomplete picture for me.
Yeah, I think, to get back to your original question of like, where do they get better? Starting pitching has to get better.
Mm-hmm, I agree.
They have some options. Like you can fill out a solid 7-8 right now. And Brandon Woodruff coming back could help. Could really, really help.
Such a wild card.
But there are wild cards up and down here right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, Tobias Myers has showed himself as a guy that you want in this rotation. You also can't project that same performance on him for a full season in his second year next year. Like that's just, I mean, that's asking for a lot.
that's asking for a lot for a guy that, you know, came in untouted, unheralded. So you gotta, you think, I don't know how you go about it, what the avenue is. Like we saw Nick Martinez, a guy like that got a qualifying offer. So obviously there's always a premium on starting pitching, but you do have to be better than you were last year. And, you know, maybe they'll look at the whole pie and see that, yeah, you know what? We do think we'll be, our numbers and everything internally says that our pitching is going to be really good this year. And maybe that's the case. Maybe that's what ends up happening. But without having those numbers in front of me, I say absolutely the starting pitching is an area of this team that has to improve.
Let's put a quick pin in that because I want to transition to the last thing that I want to talk about. And that's the guys in the minors, the guys who are going to help this team next year. And I do want to talk about a couple pitchers that absolutely could help this team next year. But I want to start with the two guys that are in the Arizona Fall League that have had some differing results. Brock Wilkin and Luis Lara. Brock Wilkin, as many people know, if they listen regularly, I'm a big fan. I thought he was going to be the third baseman in 2025. I thought that for a while. And then 2024 happened. He got hit in the face with a pitch. His offensive numbers never really got back to where they were. He went to the Arizona Fall League, a place where pitching notoriously is not very good because most teams don't want to send their pitchers to get more work after the season is over. I mean, usually that's a big no-no. You want to limit the innings. So Brock Wilkin really needed to hit there. He didn't. Yeah, it hasn't been great. He's hit a couple home runs, but it has mostly been a disappointment. And to the point that I wonder how much of the shine is off of Brock Wilkin as a bona fide prospect. It's only one bad year, but it was a big step back. Luis Lara is interesting. He's having a really good Arizona Fall League. He is a very small player, very diminutive, and doesn't really have a ton of pop, but, you know, has been pretty consistent, is one of the top prospects in the organization, has flashed some leather, and is a probably enough of a prospect at this point that you could start thinking about his place, you know, near the top shelf, near the top 10 of this organization. I want to know what your thoughts are on that. If the Arizona Fall League results have swayed you one way or the other, I'm really interested in Wilkin because that's a guy I thought would be here soon. And now I'm not sure he's going to be here at all. And that's probably pessimistic at this point, but like, where are you at with him?
One of my tenants that I've adopted in the last like 2 weeks.
Tenants, like people who rent from you?
Yes, that's right, folks. Landlord me, pay up.
Let's go.
I just don't care about the Arizona Fall League results.
Fair enough.
I'm not, just not going to read into them. It's not totally meaningless baseball, but I just cannot get myself to like look at the whole of the picture there over the years, recent years, and how, you know, Brewers prospects have performed, and be like, I can glean a whole lot of meaning from it. I just can't do that. There's just not much that you can take from the Arizona Fall League. It's a great time. It's a great league. Sometimes things do matter. Sometimes great prospects are there. You get to learn a lot about them. Like if I'm there and watching these guys, that's probably a little different, but I'm not. So that's kind of where I stand on it. As for Wilkin, JR, do you want the good news or the bad news?
Let's start with the bad. I want you to let me down slowly. What's the bad news?
The bad news is breaking balls low and away are total kryptonite.
There's a lot of those in the big leagues. They have some of those in the big leagues.
There are players like that in the big leagues.
There are breaking balls low and away in the big leagues.
Yeah.
I don't think there are many players who can't hit them.
There's some players that can get by without hitting them. But
Carlos Stanton?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Oh, yes. So there you go. There's your comp. I'm done. There's your good news.
All right. Giancarlo Stanton.
The good news is that reports that you're hearing on him are like the defense is okay. It's not going to be gold glove. It's not going to win awards. But he might actually be able to play third base. And if not, like he's a good enough mover laterally, that first base would also work. So there you go. There's the good news.
All right, I'm into it.
And the other part of it too is like people that are evaluating him, the common thing you hear is about getting hit in the face. it just throws a little bit of a question mark into everything, and people are willing to give him another go at it next year. Now there's these big question marks and these flags that have been raised that next year will need to be addressed, and the play will need to make those go away, but they're still there. And so it's not over for Brock Wilkin. He's probably, I mean, optimistically, the eighth or ninth best prospect in the system. That's pretty optimistic. And then pessimistic, you know, I could see someone putting him at like 25 if you were super pessimistic. So a wide range there for sure.
Oh, I'm sad. Who are the minor leaguers that are going to make an impact in 2025? I'm going to give you a list, and you could tell me if they, you know, maybe this is a good jumping off point. Carlos Rodriguez pitched in the big leagues this year briefly. Didn't go great, but he was kind of pressed into duty. He's on the 40-man roster. I bet you see him this year.
Yeah, sure. He'll be a depth arm.
Yeah. Tyler Black is a bit of a puzzle because we don't know where he fits defensively, but he was obviously here quite a bit. And then you got a bunch of guys who are really exciting. Logan Henderson, who will be added to the 40-man roster as a possible back-end rotation guy. Jacob Mizorowski, a guy that we've talked a lot about as a big-time rotation guy and maybe one of those guys that makes the rotation better without the Brewers having to go out and sign anybody. Jefferson Caro was hurt all last year. I don't imagine we see him, certainly not right away in 2025, maybe eventually, depending on if he proves ready as a backup during, you know, once he's back to full health after that shoulder issue. And then Craig Yoho, a reliever that we talked a great deal about.
Yes.
I think he breaks camp. He breaks camp. Come on. Craig Yoho has got to be on this roster.
I think he could work his way into the conversation, but JR, have you looked at the bullpen picture?
It's so crowded.
Like, unless both Ashby and DL Hall are in the rotation, which I just don't see that happening. Maybe it does. But just as is, without them adding anyone, I left Abner Uribe out of my bullpen.
I completely forgot about him.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe there'll be injuries. Maybe Yoho pitches away. Sure. I shouldn't douse your flaming idea with my water of hate.
Yes.
Ernesto Martinez?
Sure. Yeah. He's a guy who was brought back on a minor league deal. He's not yet on the 40-man roster, but he has done very, very well in Biloxi. He's the
exit
type of
velos
guy
that, there are intriguing.
Yeah, I think he's the type of guy that you don't think about initially out of the gate, and then he ends up having a run with the team. Like, he's on the team for a month.
Yeah, yeah. But how often do those guys end up hitters, position players? How often do those guys end up really mattering in the grand scheme on like winning ball clubs? It doesn't feel like it's very often. Now, Ernesto Martinez is the guy who maybe he breaks that mold because he is a different cat.
He's a hell of an athlete. He's a good defensive first baseman.
He's probably still gaining power. Like just a late blooming type prospect who's not going to be on any list, but has insane exit velocity. So like, he's a little different in that regard. Yeah. And you could always tap into something with those sort of like Brannion type hitters. But most of the time it's the pitchers.
I feel like if there is a trade to be made, it will involve some of the relievers that we think of as big league relievers. Maybe it involves Aaron Ashby. Maybe it involves even a Brian Hudson or somebody that hasn't been here very long. And that clears room for some of these other guys because they have just so many options. And I don't think Mizorowski starts the year on the big league roster because I think they're so equipped and they're going to try to make him a starter, and that's going to require a little more work in the minors. But I feel like if there's a trade, it's got to be out of that depth. There's too many guys.
Yeah. The first couple of months are going to be super, super important for Mizorowski and his like long-term development, because if it's not working out as a starter, I don't know how long they let that leash go when they could use him in the big leagues as an impact reliever last September. You know what I mean? Like, they already could have used that. So in some capacity, he can pitch in the big leagues early to middle of the year, no doubt. And if it's not working out as a starter, like, how long do you let that continue when you
could just flip the switch and go, all right, you're going to pitch the eighth inning.
Yeah.
And he could be really, really good in that role. And, but well, then, like, can you go back after that? I guess you could, Garrett Crochet, but also Josh Hader. So
they should sign Garrett Crochet. You know, by not bringing him to the big league team, they bought themselves some leash. I mean, they could leave him down there all year. I don't think that'll happen. But like you said, they don't have to make that decision until, you know, August, I guess, if they really want, if they're headed towards the playoffs and they say, okay, we need that guy as a hammer in our bullpen, they wouldn't have to make that call until August.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
I want to talk about a couple other prospects, a couple guys that I want to get your thoughts on. Cooper Pratt and Jesus Mate.
Yes, JR.
Also, Yofury Rodriguez we'll talk about briefly, but Cooper Pratt, he won a minor league gold glove, which is a testament to his defense at shortstop and just a pretty nice icing on the cake for a player who worked at multiple levels in the organization. One of the top, he was the co-minor league player of the year, was 20 years old, 19, 20 years old for this season. And, ended up coming up to Biloxi for the playoffs, hit a home run over a train, in the playoffs, which was pretty impressive. But I presume he'll start at AA. He'll start at Biloxi. And I don't imagine that there's any chance he gets to the big leagues. He's not going to get to the big leagues in 2025, but he is way, way up there. Arguably going to be, if Mizorowski moves off this list, the number one prospect in this organization. What do you think of him right now? Where is your head at in terms of when he could be here and how great he could be?
He's probably not going to be in the big leagues in 2025. Oh,
you're not ruling it out.
I am not ruling it out. No.
Interesting.
Especially if the kid starts in Biloxi, where it seems like he's most likely to fit in. I'm not going to rule it out.
I love that.
I don't want to give away our prospect list because we're doing it a little different this offseason. We're going to unveil one player in the top 10 each day till we get to the bottom. Okay. But boy, oh boy, Cooper Pratt is in the running for the top spot. And that's, and I mean, that, like, there's our evaluation of him in that. But there's a lot of other people that we trust and their evaluation in that as well. And there's some people with the Brewers that really, really, really like Cooper Pratt. And like, yeah, you should have him in that conversation for sure. Which is interesting, very interesting. But you look at the whole body of work in this season that he had, and you start to see why. Like, out of all their prospects, who has maybe the best? Like, I don't want to say the Sal Frelick comp because it's a little different. But like, who has that floor? Like that really solid floor of okay, at the very worst, he's a solid big leaguer. Probably Cooper Pratt, right? Like pitcher version Robert Gasser. But it's Cooper Pratt because he plays a really solid shorts, like surprisingly good for me at least, shortstop defense. I did not know it was gonna work, but it seems like it's going to. And they might actually be moving Made over on the dirt, still in the dirt, but over on the dirt because they have guys like Cooper Pratt at short. And the power gains are coming along. Like there's still a fair amount of projection that still needs to be had there, or that is being had and still needs to realize the potential. But the bat to ball skills are pretty great. The swing decisions are pretty good. He's still only 20. Cooper Pratt's pretty good. He's a pretty good prospect.
Meanwhile, everybody in the Brewers prospect sphere is getting pretty drunk on the idea of where Jesus Mate could end up next year. He's 17. He is absolutely, you know, like it, when Jackson Churio at age 20 has a 2020 season, becomes the first big leaguer to do that. You don't want to throw that name around lightly anymore, but we are absolutely talking about a player who could be on that trajectory. There is a possibility Mate will compete to be the top prospect in baseball over the next year. Let's say extremely lofty expectations at this point for somebody so young. It's very difficult to project that when you're talking about somebody so young. I mean, this we've seen really young players get to A ball and it falls apart very quickly. It's almost irresponsible to talk about him the way that we've started talking about him. But there seems to be stuff there that you just don't see with other prospects.
When the industry catches on to a guy like this, you take notice. When a team starts talking about, like, talking about that hype in a way of like, yeah, that absolutely is warranted, you really take notice. And that's where I'm at with Jesus Madé right now. Our boy from the very beginning, from last January 15th, Jesus made, like, it's just, it's an elite combination of exit velos and great swing decisions and good bat to ball. And he can also run a little bit and play a little defense where it's like, yeah, that's how Jackson Churio got to be a top five prospect by the time he was 18 and a half years old.
Mm-hmm.
And Madé ain't turning 18 until next May. He's younger than Churio was a year ago at this time. And the Brewers are pretty dang set on him starting at Carolina, where Churio, if you remember, he didn't get there until early May. So you don't want to compare players because, you know, the way that Churio seems to, the way that Churio, yeah, it's unavoidable. Churio has set a precedent that is like, he realized the potential he had, but Madé has that exact same potential, just at a different position, just in a little bit of a different package. But there's really not a thing on the baseball field in terms of like the acute skills that he doesn't do that makes you super intrigued. And again, it's the buzz from the industry, it's the buzz from the team, all around a guy that, you know, makes you like almost want to tap like hey, let's like you're it makes you want to tap the brakes a little bit, and that's probably fair to do as well. But and we should tap the brakes on him a bit as like, okay, maybe it doesn't work out, but if it does,
it's pretty special, you know. And it's also worth noting that this is possibly the fruits of the labor that the Brewers put in on this, you know, Latin Academy thing. Like, they really have put their resources here, and it might just be that they are better equipped to identify guys like this, because Yofiri Rodriguez is another name. Like, I feel like Jesus Madé has stolen some of the shine off of Yofiri Rodriguez, because he was, in my mind, like that's the next Churio comp, and he is a top 10 prospect in this organization.
Yeah, he's a good prospect. Young. Just with, you know, like a ball exposed a lot of questions about him. He had a really good year still, and like his swing decisions are all okay. Maybe his swing decisions aren't quite as good, but like he still draws walks. So like, there's a lot of great things in Yofiri Rodriguez's game, but it's clear that he ain't at this level.
No, it's going to take him a little time, and he may still be very good. But again, like maybe the Latin.
But yeah, Academy, no, I get what you're saying.
It out.
None of these guys, Churio, Caro, Madé, Yofiri Rodriguez, I mean, Lara, if you want to, you know, lump him in there, none of them were super duper highly touted, like league wide,
right?
You know, because a lot of times I think the league wide rankings are based upon signing bonuses, and it's just it's really tough to compare 16-year-old baseball players.
Yeah.
And so, you know, sometimes, you know, the Brewers are giving a guy, and it's clear that he's at the top. He's one of the top guys in their class, like Madé was last year. He wasn't even the top signing bonus. That was Jorge Quintana.
Who's also good.
So, like, Madé was, there was one outlet, I think, that didn't rank him. I don't, or maybe it was Pena. Someone didn't rank Pena. Anyway, like, he was in the 30s, the 40s, because he, you know, wasn't seen in that corner of the, you know, like the baseball world. It's a very small corner as being the 2 million signing bonus guy, but the Brewers are really good at finding them and signing them and developing them.
Well, Juan Baez signed for $10,000, right? It's a Craig Yoho all over again, only on the international market. Yeah. Like, that's a guy who is
Abner Ribe was, I think, 70,000.
Incredible. They're getting these, they're identifying star players, and they don't even need to break the international signing bank to get them. It's working out really well. I want to ask real quickly about two more players. We're getting a little long here, but Braylon Payne, the first round pick this past year, I honestly wasn't paying attention to how he was doing, to be quite frank, because in my mind, his role there was a lottery ticket type talent who you draft because you can save some money on your first round pick, and you can say, you know, the possibility to save the most in the first round comes into play there, and you use that money to sign other players in the slot system. The Brewers ultimately weren't able to sign all of the guys that they wanted in the later rounds, so I thought he's not really a first round talent, and it's kind of a disappointment. But he did okay. He was pretty solid once he got into the Brewers organization.
No, I think.
Have you changed your mind on him?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, when he was first drafted, there was a lot of questions. And it did seem like it was just a signing savings pick with upside, with real upside, of course. And his signing bonus wasn't quite as low as I think a lot of us anticipated it was going to be. And then he gets to Pro Bowl and he's like popping exit velocities. And you talk to Brewers people and they're like, did you see that? You see what he's doing?
And we were saving money, and we actually just got a baller.
And oh, by the way, this kid's going to be a really, really good center fielder, and he's obviously very fast because of that. So there's that part of his game too. So, I mean, yeah, there's still a lot of questions with the swing, but it's an interesting package for sure, and he has no doubt shot his way just through like a couple months of Pro Bowl into top 15 range in my mind. Don't want to give it all away, but yeah, no, he'll be ranked in that area when our rankings come out. There's some people that, you know, there's still some skeptics on him, no doubt, in the industry. I mean, he wasn't ranked super highly coming into the draft, but he's certainly turned some heads with his performance.
Eric Batanti, along with Cooper Pratt,
yes,
kind of the two gems of the 2023 draft. Those were the guys that they spent the extra money on. Batanti is not step for step with Cooper Pratt, but he's a guy with pretty good power and pretty impressive stuff where he has played. What do you think the future holds for him in 2025?
So Baseball America, I think it was, published a story not long ago talking about swing decisions and prospects. And Batanti was one of the players that they touted as a model swing decision hitter, which is interesting because if you just look at the surface stats, he strikes out a ton, and that's because his contact rates are not great. Maybe you could get a little more granular with the swing decision stuff and say like there's specific areas per hitter. If you do a hitter by hitter basis, that it's not quite as good. And that's probably why he's striking out too much. Like needs to be more aggressive in this area. But nevertheless, that's really interesting from him. But yeah, I mean, the contact rates are still fairly concerning, and he's probably just a first baseman. So I'm always going to have some skepticism about a prospect who's carrying, I don't know, you project like 35% strikeouts in the big leagues. Like that's probably not going to work in most cases. It's not a death sentence at all. And like his barrel numbers, the Brewers PD post stuff like that. You know, you want to get into all the nerdy stats stuff. Like he's great in he's absolutely great in those areas. And then you see him play, and you're like, oh yeah, that's like 70 raw power. So Eric Batanti's a fun one, and it'll be his first full year. I wonder if he starts in Carolina or not, maybe Wisconsin. I bet he starts in Wisconsin, and so. We'll see what happens in his toughest taste of pitching yet in his career and the cold weather and all that.
Who is the prospect most likely to come out of nowhere and become a key contributor a la Tobias Myers? And why is it Casey Hunt?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Co-pitcher of the year in the organization, minor league pitcher.
I don't want to give it all away. I did a lot of I watched every one of Casey Hunt's AA starts, and so that it's been charted, and that will be content. Casey Hunt, I'm high on him. I'm high on Casey Hunt.
Who is the prospect that you're most interested in knowing more about this season? And we've said a lot of names already, but somebody who you think has the potential to take a leap forward in the minors, somebody that's, you know, is a question mark for you. Who's got your, you know, who's intrigued you?
It's Luis Peña.
Okay, interesting.
It's Luis Peña. The DSL numbers are super flashy. There's still some questions about it that we'll learn a lot more about in stateside ball in terms of basically like how much can he not chase? and allow the rest of his game to play up. And also, you know, you get to see these guys on defense. Like, it's going to be a guy who gets stateside for the first time and has that profile that I'm most intrigued to see. Because I want to say, like, I want to say he's not as far behind Jesus Madé as, you know, you'd think. In best case, he's really not. But there's also more risk in his game probably than Madé's. But I don't know if he's getting talked about like as enough, especially relative to Madé. So I don't think he's not going to start at Carolina probably. I would guess he starts at the complex and then works his way up, but that's probably the guy for me.
All right. Last question. We'll make our first 2025 season prediction. Who of players, debating whether to just do rookies or we could maybe do two different camps, rookies or players who have yet to make their big league debut. That's not necessarily the same thing. Who do you think ends up with the highest WAR total in 2025 among these players?
Ooh,
I have what I think is a pretty good answer. I think it's Logan Henderson. I think Logan Henderson ends up making a lot of starts for the 2025 Brewers and ultimately winds up with the highest WAR for no other reason because he's pitching a lot. The Brewers don't have a lot of openings for like playing time. There's not a lot of obvious places. You know, unless there's a third baseman who materializes, where minor leaguers are going to absorb a lot of the playing time. So it's kind of hard to really say there are many spots, you know, like Logan Henderson's an obvious spot.
Man, that's a really good question. I'm going to go with Craig Yoho.
You are going with Yoho. I love that.
With Craig Yoho. Yeah.
Makes my heart sing.
There's just not a lot left that you need to see in the minor leagues. The stuff is the stuff. He locates it well. He has seemingly figured out how to use it and sequence it. Like, get the man up, get him some innings in the big leagues, and I think he pitches really well. And I, you know, that's how you accumulate WAR. I'm like hesitant to pick a reliever for this because obviously
you just don't have any chances.
That's the toughest. Yeah, you're not used much. That's the toughest position to accumulate WAR, and like the Brewers shuttle these, you know, these relievers back and forth with options. They could yo-ho. So Henderson's a great pick too, but I got to go with our guy Yoho.
All right, good enough. Any last thoughts before we send you away?
Jesus made.
He's Kurt Hoag, Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. Back from vacation, locked in. Big UWM season afoot. They going to win the Horizon League, Kurt? I think so. I'm feeling it. Feeling like a Horizon Championship on the horizon for Barlandia.
Regular season or tournament? Because regular season doesn't matter.
Let's do both. Let's sweep it. Sweep it up.
Let's go Panthers.
As if any normal human could predict any outcome in the Horizon League tournament, even between the 1 and the 8 seed. It's absolute mayhem and anarchy. But
that conference is fun because that's the way it is. It's even.
Yeah, we'll pretend like we can envision it. Double dip for the Panthers. They go to the NCAA tournament. You're here first. We will we'll be back. We'll be back soon, probably next week after some of the awards have been handed out. We'll figure out where Pat Murphy landed and probably talk more about Pat Murphy. And then that'll do it. So thank you for tuning into this edition of Micro Brew. We'll chat with you again very soon. Bye bye.
Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. The world of fast fashion has complicated clothing production by shipping cheap parts around the world to whoever can sew them the cheapest. And now you, the consumer, are paying the price with rising costs. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. Skip the tariff and snag yourself American-made clothing with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
Imagine a school day built around your child's needs and interests. It's possible with K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited, tuition-free, online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn from state-certified teachers trained to teach online. And with the flexibility to learn wherever there's internet, it can fit into any family schedule. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. You can make the switch at any time. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more.